We're going to talk about the process of healing today. And the first thing I'd like to do is read you a quotation. Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. That sounds like the kind of thing that maybe the guy who conquered Mount Everest would have said. Actually, it was Helen Keller. The first thing that I want to offer you is, if your goal in pursuing this thing called healing is to get this problem behind you and just get on with a smooth sailing life, think again. As this quotation illustrates, life is not a matter of security. Security is mainly an illusion. There's really no such thing in human experience. You can't see what the next problem in your life will be because of this current problem, but there will be one. Now, that may be good news and bad news. For the eating disordered lady, the good news is you don't have to be an ick the rest of your life. You do not have to be a recovering addict the rest of your life. You're not always going to have your identity focused around your addiction. You won't always be an anorexic or a bulimic. The point is that even when you continue in the recovery process, if your focus or identity continues to revolve around not being addicted, you're still caught in that same spiral. And so the good news is you can get beyond this. One of our visitors was here a few minutes ago. She was here for chapel. I think she was medical record number 004, almost 2 years ago now, and has been a year and a half, 20 months maybe, without a single eating disorder symptom. Not a one. It really can't happen. She's had some other problems in her life since then, though, and she's continuing in that path of growth and development. So, yes, you can get beyond your eating disorder, but no, you can't develop a problem-free life. And in fact, if you want to pursue this process of healing, the place to start is by changing the title and calling it the adventure of healing. Because in fact, what it's going to take is that you learn to cultivate a taste for adventure instead of always hungering for security. I'm going to describe some of the stages of therapy that we take women through in the program here. And to one extent or another, they are sequential. There's a place you start, and then the next step, and then a third step. But in another sense, it's cyclical, because some of the steps that I'll describe are things that you go through many times, but both while you're here and also after you go home. And secondly, I think it's fairly self-evident by this point in the week that this adventure of healing is not only for the eating disordered woman. The question again is, what are you in recovery from? What are you needing to get some healing about in your own life? So let's talk about some of the stages in that. Step one, discovery of woundedness. You remember we've been talking all week about that calloused over heart. So that people oftentimes walk around saying, no, there's nothing wrong with me. And then you look at their heart and you say, yes, but I see layer after layer after layer of calluses. What's that about? Oh, I don't know. Well, how about we peel them off and see? Oh, yeah, now I see how I'm wounded. There was a story several months ago on the news about a woman who had surgery to have a tumor removed. When the tumor was removed, it weighed 180 pounds. 180-pound tumor. Now, I mean, how did everybody not notice it? How did she not notice it? How did the doctors not notice it for so long? How did that problem go unaddressed for so long? Well, the answer in this particular case is she weighed 700 pounds. So it kind of got lost in there. That, in many ways, is the way your pain has been, perhaps. That your pain, your woundedness, has been lost in the overwhelming weight of all of the other factors in your life. But you can't keep neglecting it, because it will be like that tumor. It will grow to all kinds of proportions. So, we start with discovery of woundedness. I went down the wrong tube, huh? Okay. A couple of things that we talk about routinely here. One of them is this process of denial. Denial is part of what keeps those wounds undiscovered. Denial is an unconscious process. It's not something. It's not the same as somebody lying to you. That's conscious. But when a person's in denial, what we mean is that their mind has deliberately disguised or cloaked or deceived them from the truth so that they wouldn't hurt. Now, when you are in an overwhelming trauma, your mind automatically does denial for you and other kinds of defense mechanisms so that you don't go crazy. In that kind of a situation, your defense mechanisms, denial included, are very helpful. They keep you alive. But once that trauma has ceased and the defense mechanisms continue, then they begin to get in your way. And so when a woman comes in for treatment and she's wanting to give up her eating disorder, and she's saying, but I don't think it's really that bad. See, now her defense mechanisms are getting in her way. Or when she's wanting a life of wholeness, but she keeps saying, well, I think it's just because my pancreas doesn't work right. Well, she's probably using denial. Her pancreas might not work right, but I doubt that's the whole problem. And as long as she continues to focus just on that physical symptom, then she's not going to get the whole issue or wound addressed and healed. So we're going to help people work on their defense mechanisms, including denial, so that they can more easily acknowledge the woundedness. Second thing here, acceptance of neediness. Last Friday in Didactic with the residents, we talked about what the first step is in the 12 steps of wholeness, admitting our own powerlessness and the unmanageable state of our life when we continue to try to manage that over which we have no power. And again, I was struck with the reality of the finite nature of any human resources. Now, I know that some of you are extremely competent individuals, that many of you are extremely achieved individuals. You've done a lot with your life. And I want to ask you if you have yet discovered the limitations to your own self. If you have not, hang around. You will. Sooner or later, you will run up against something bigger than you are. And my question then is, what do you do? What do you do then? How do you deal with the fact that at some point or another, you must say to another individual, to God, I need. You remember Sunday night, Ward starting us off, talking about the therapist's suggestion that he go to his daughter and say, I need your love. Not just I enjoy having you around, I expect you to eat dinner. I need your love. Acceptance of our own neediness is not easy for us. We want to remain invulnerable and invincible. And it is a mask. It is not the truth about the human soul. We all have limitations. And so we will help people as best we can discover their own powerlessness. In what area of your life are you powerless? And how has that affected your life negatively to such an extent that that area of your life is unmanageable? And what do you want to do about it? So that's where we start in the healing process. A couple of other things that we talk about during this stage of the therapy process. We have to do a lot of discussion and healing around issues and patterns of shame and guilt. In many ways, shame and guilt are the same thing. There are two or three different ways to look at it. I want to give you a couple of different ones. One is guilt is about bad behavior, and shame is about bad being. Guilt is when I feel like I've done something wrong. Shame is when I feel like I am defective, that my nature is wrong. Now, the way they're related is this. Sometimes we can do so much that makes us feel guilty, or we can be accused of doing so much that makes us feel guilty, that it piles on and on and on until it convinces us that we must be worthless, and then it turns into shame. So in that sense, shame is like guilt compounded to the nth degree. That's one way that they are related. Another way that they are oftentimes related is this. Have you done some things in your life that are just flat wrong? That you have violated your own freely chosen moral standards? I assume the answer is yes. So far, I haven't met anybody who could stand up to, well, I mean, you know, the press does it to anybody who runs for office, don't they? It's like, I can't believe Clinton actually dodged the draft. I mean, it's like, give me a break. Everybody has done things that, in one way or another, violates their own moral standards. And when you feel guilty about that, good. I'm glad. When you don't feel guilty for violating your own moral standards, we call you a sociopath. We call you an antisocial personality disorder. That's part of what makes a sociopath is not having a conscience, not feeling guilty when they violate their own standards. So I'm glad, to one extent or another, that you have a conviction inside when you do wrong. However, many of you feel wrong when anybody does something wrong. You know, like the Gulf War, and somehow you feel like it's your fault. Oh, dear, what did I do wrong? I should have been able to control world peace. Or take it back down to the family. Oh, my gosh, they're fighting. It must be my fault. And I feel guilty for my parents' conflict. Or I feel guilty because my sister and dad can't get along. Or I feel guilty because a member of my family died and somehow must be my fault. When you have those kinds of false feelings of guilt, those can be equated with shame. So there's a couple of different ways that shame and guilt are related. Now, we do a lot of work on shame and guilt issues here. One of the things we do is help people develop that tough mind that we've been talking about all week. Wait a second. Is your parents' conflict in any way related to you? Well, yeah, they were fighting because I got in trouble and they didn't know how to handle it. Okay, so you got in trouble. Whose problem was it that they didn't know how to handle it? Well, I guess it was theirs. Yeah, I guess it was too. Why don't you let them have it? It's not yours, it's theirs. Let them have it. So we work on helping them develop a tough mind that can deal with the truth. The other thing we do is help them deal with true patterns of guilt in their lives. Now, this is one of the reasons that I am a Christian psychologist, not just a psychologist who happens to be a Christian. I went to school longer than anybody ought to, I think, and I have read a lot about moral issues in psychology and in mental health. And unfortunately, I have not found real successful answers for the issue of guilt outside of a religious answer, a spiritual answer. Here's how a lot of secular texts encourage you to take care of guilt. If you feel guilty for violating a standard, just lower your standard, and then you won't feel guilty. Now, there's some logic to it. If you are a perfectionist and you feel guilty when it's anything less than absolutely perfect, well, they'll lower your standard and you won't feel so guilty. So there is some logic to that. When Zara gets the whole play right but misses one line and feels guilty, maybe the standard's a little high. See, lower the standard and she won't feel so guilty. However, who among you would tell your daughter, oh, I'm sorry you feel guilty for sleeping with the dude. Just lower your standards and then it won't bother you. See, that logic has some limitations, doesn't it? In your own life, when you violate the standards that you chose, what's the solution? Throw your standards out the window? No. Somehow there's got to be what the Catholics call absolution, which means washing away. There's got to be something that'll get you cleaned up when you've fouled yourself. And I don't think you can do that outside of a religious answer. I think it requires a religious answer. And of all the world religions that I know about, and I don't know a lot about all world religions, but of all the world religions I know about, Christianity seems to have the most internal integrity and functional usefulness in life, day to day. So I use a Christian framework to help people deal with the pattern of guilt. I'll tell you straight out of the Bible. You remember the prodigal son? This kid who wasted away his dad's resources on the absolute kind of lifestyle that you wouldn't want for your son. Prostitution, gambling, partying, drugs, booze, and ended up literally in the pigsty, feeding the pigs, wishing he had that good of food. And decided he'd go back and ask his dad if he could just be a servant, because he knew he wouldn't let him be a son again. And you remember the dad's response. The dad welcomed him, filthy as he was, with open arms, didn't wait till he had a shower, hugged him first, and threw a party for his return. Absolutely not one word of incrimination. His dad didn't even sit down and do a truth and love list first. His dad just said, "You're my son. How could you think I would ever change that?" See, that's how God responds when you're out of line. Of course you're out of line. So? You're still my kid. His response is absolutely unconditional. That's how I encourage people to take care of the patterns of guilt in their own lives so that it can be cleaned up, washed away. Now, let me tell you about the other pattern in this initial period of discovery that's so essential, and that is self-acceptance. You see, I can tell that story about the prodigal son and say, you know, God really does love you that much. And somebody's going to say, yeah, but you don't know everything I've done. That story about the prodigal son, that's tame compared to me. Let me tell you about me. There's no way he could still love me. You see, this pattern of self-acceptance has to go hand in hand with experiencing acceptance from God. It can't be one or the other. You can do all the religious preaching you want to, and if a person still hates herself, she won't receive God's love. So we're going to work on just a pure old psychological level of self-acceptance. Wait a second. What's the only relationship in your life that you will never depart from? Your relationship with yourself. That's exactly right. You're the only one who won't ever leave you. That relationship is absolutely essential to nurture and cultivate. So we want you to learn to have mercy on yourself, to cherish yourself, to respond in nurturing ways to yourself rather than in punishing and abusive ways. So we're going to work on just a pure psychological level with self-acceptance as well as helping with patterns of guilt through experiencing the acceptance of God. That's step one. Questions so far? What about the kids' feelings and responsibility? I will also interpret or imply from what you're asking. The kids' opening line, by the way, is, "Dad, I have absolutely blown it, and I'm not worthy to be your son. Could I just be one of your servants?" So he did own up and ask to rectify that relationship. Because, see, you know, God doesn't really need anything from you. He's kind of got it together. But in human relationships, it's got to be reciprocal. It's got to be mutual. By the way, this list work that you do in the afternoons is not unique to us. Many addictions programs use list work in dealing with these troubled relationships. But one of the things that we do differently is, in your list work, we ask you to say, "I need and I expect." And in many programs, they will say, "Don't have any expectations," because you just put pressure on those relationships. I think that's unrealistic. In the human relationships of commitment, there are expectations. There are needs. They need to be reciprocal relationships, mutual give and take. And so I think that's very true, that as we extend forgiveness, we also need to be asking for forgiveness. As we extend making right the relationship, we need to be asking to make right the relationship. I agree. Okay. Next step in the healing process. letting go of childish things. I want to give you four or five illustrations of things that we think are childish and that we work with our residents to give up, to let go of. One of them would be childish expectations. And the principal childish expectation is this: I want what I want when I want it. Now see, we understand that when kids operate like that, it's kind of normal. Children are what we call egocentric. Not the same thing as selfish or proud. It's similar, but what it means is they assume their ego, their self, is the center of the universe, and that everything occurs around them. Children are egocentric. And sometimes it's even kind of cute. We see a little 2-year-old kind of throw a temper tantrum, and we go, oh, poor baby. But when a 20-year-old throws a temper tantrum because she doesn't get what she wants when she wants it, it's not real cute. It's mildly irritating, at least. And yet, many of us have not given up this childish expectation. We still think that we ought to get what we want when we want it. Now, let's take that to the logical conclusion, shall we? When I want what I want when I want it, I'm assuming that all of the factors involved in that condition should come to pass to make sure I get what I want when I want it, right? And all of the factors involved to those factors ought to coincide to make sure I get what I want when I want it, and all of the factors related to that. In other words, what we are assuming is that we are wise enough or big enough to run the universe. That everything in the universe ought to go by my plan to make sure that I get what I want when I want it. That is pretty childish, isn't it? So what are you doing throwing a fit when you don't get your way? Grow up, right? That's childish. You cannot continue in recovery as long as you hold on to that attitude. I guarantee you that your family is not going to do it right when you go home. She's going to cook country fried steak and with gravy and expect you to eat it. And you go, Mom, that's not on my exchange. That's at least 3 breads and 5 meats. I mean, I can't. Yeah, right, Michelle? You're going to go home and you're going to think, you know, I heard a lot about this church stuff. I think I'll go check it out. And you're going to walk into church and somebody there is going to say, are you one of us? And absolutely blow it. And your response is, well, forget this. I didn't get what I thought I wanted when I needed it, so walk. See, if this is your attitude, you won't make it in life. Okay? You got to let this go. That's a childish expectation. Pleasures or rewards that are perfect. Husbands, have you ever given the wrong gift for Valentine's? Which, by the way, is tomorrow. Hint, hint. Have you ever, you can see it on her face, right? Gee, thanks. Now, I'm not talking about when you give her a fishing pole, But I'm talking about when you really do try to give her a gift that you think she'll enjoy and it just wasn't the perfect one. Or you're in therapy together and she says, you know, honey, it really would help me if you would buy me flowers every once in a while just because. And so you do it the next day and she says, yeah, but I had to tell you. It's like, see, children expect Prince Charming on a white horse with absolute... I mean, I don't think Prince Charming's horse poops, you know? I mean, we're talking perfect rewards and pleasures in life. And that is not realistic. That's a childish expectation. I think we got the point on that, didn't we? Okay, third one. Perfect parents. When I was in graduate school, I spent a year in a seminar in learning how to do therapy about people's families of origin, the families that they grew up in. How do you do those things? And the way we learned to do it was by doing our own. And so actually what I did was spend a year in a seminar, in a group therapy on my own family of origin. About halfway through that, as Karen and I began to deal with some of my own issues with my parents, I was at a place of being really angry with them. And Karen was madder with them than I was, because she really idolized my folks after we'd been married several years. For 6 months, we did not talk to them. Once a month, we'd call them to let them know that the kids were okay, and that was it. And we had had real close spiritual relationships. So they knew things were cooking, and we just told them, we're not ready to talk about it. Kids are fine. Talk to you next month. For 6 months. We had them up for a Saturday. We did a Saturday marathon, truth and love, basically. A lot of crying and a little bit of yelling. In our family, we don't do anger real well. Worked through a lot of that stuff. And it was really painful. And yet extremely healing and good for us. The most painful thing was letting go of the image of my father as a saint. I was raised a missionary's kid. I have been personally a Christian since I was 10. And my parents, I mean, I was born into a healthy family. My grandparents and their parents don't have any history as of drug or alcohol abuse, or, I mean, we have a relatively healthy extended family. I never even went through an adolescent rebellion. When I graduated from college, I was still so straight, I'd never seen a joint. I mean, I you know, you could have eaten your dinner off my skin. I was so squeaky clean, you know? My dad was worse than that. My father led me to God. And he did his doctorate in the philosophy of religion. And our dinner conversations were about the deep things of God. And so when I was 27 and he left Mom for a year and a half and had an affair, and when they absolutely blew it with my little sister, I was furious. I was absolutely furious because they were not measuring up. Now, parents, you know that pressure, don't you? You know that you're not what they think you are, and yet we kind of encourage it because it feels good for them to think that we are perfect. And children, who's not a child in here? All of us have parents? Yeah. We continue to hold our parents to unrealistic expectations. Now, here's what it costs you. When you cannot be realistic about who your parents are, you cannot receive what they have to offer because you keep expecting something or other or more than they have to offer. And so letting go of that expectation frees you to accept what they really are, whatever that may be, however small it may be, however little they may have to give, it will free you to be able to accept that. So we got to let go of that expectation of perfect parents and other perfect relationships. I don't think that it's the best form of marital problem solving to trade him in on a new model. The chances are real good the next one's not going to be any better. Remember Ward saying Monday morning about divorce statistics. They get higher the greater the number of times you've been married. Stay where you're at and figure out what to do about it now. Don't go swapping them in for another one, because chances are this is what you're doing, is expecting perfect relationships. Fourth one. Well, that's enough on that one. We've already talked about the other two. Letting go of childish things. Now, the next stage in this healing process, this adventure of healing that I'm going to describe, may sound kind of contradictory. Accepting the child within. I'm going to explain what that means, but first I want to tell you why that's so important. How many of you have had one of your kids, or you may have said it yourself, say something about hating the idea of becoming an adult? My 9-year-old said the other day, you know, it had been a particularly long week at work, and Christopher said, "Dad, I don't think I want to grow up, if that's what being grown up means. I want to play." And you know that feeling. As you can accept the fact that there lives on inside you a child, it will make adulthood tolerable. This is the key to being able to accept adulthood. Now let's go back and explain and then elaborate. First, how do you tell the difference between childish and the child within? There's a verse in the New Testament that is a marvelous way of describing it. Jesus said, unless you become as a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, what is it about a child that is ready for heaven? What are children like that makes them that acceptable? What are they like?
Pure?
Innocent? Non-judgmental? Peaceable? Trusting? Teachable? What? Open-minded? Honest? Painfully so sometimes?
Unashamed?
Humble?
They're not black and white.
A kid blows through life and they're like a refreshment, aren't they? They're not self-conscious. They're not self-absorbed. They just go for it. They become wrapped up in life. They know that they're needy and they're not ashamed of it. You ever seen a kid say, I'm so ashamed, but I want to sit in your lap? They're spontaneous. They're uninhibited. You can see a child pull out his daytimer and see if he can work you in. No. Children are trusting. They're not suspicious. They don't always have to have a plan. They don't always have their guard up. Now, I mean, I do that list every month, and I still get tingles when I think about what it's like to live as a child. So how come we don't do that? How come we don't live like a child? Yeah, that's one of the reasons. There's two reasons. One of the reasons is children get hurt. And so all of us have had our child within go into hiding. Let's forget this. I know what it's like out there. It's not a real pleasant place for children sometimes. And so our children go into hiding and we grow this tough exterior that can protect them. Only it makes adulthood real boring. And if you can remember your child and know how to nurture her or him, it will make adulthood acceptable and fun and enjoyable. But secondly, children don't do some things real well. There are several things that children don't do well that they need an adult to do for them. The first one is get their needs met. See, that's why children have parents. Because children are not equipped to get their own needs met. Parents are supposed to do that for the kids. What about the child in you? Who's going to meet his needs? You are. The adult part of you has got to learn to meet the child part of you's needs. There's nobody else who can get to that child anymore. You must become, in a sense, your own best parent. You must learn to get your own needs met. And that needs an adult functioning to learn how to do that. Because mommy and daddy are not going to be able to meet your needs anymore. You've grown up. You're old enough to learn to be your own parent now, to meet your own needs. Second thing kids don't do really well is reality. You know, I mean, a kid watches Superman and thinks that looks fun and goes and jumps off the building. If parents don't tell him, wait a minute, that's make-believe. Humans really can't fly. Because children don't do reality real well. And your child inside doesn't do reality real well. Your child is depending on your adult to be able to handle reality. So you've got to live like an adult. You've got to have that ability to deal realistically with the world. And then finally, children don't do responsibility real well. That's news, isn't it? I've been telling our children four nights in a row to fold clothes. They still haven't done it. Children don't do responsibility real well. They need an adult to help them with responsibility. If you stay in your child all the time, you will be irresponsible and unrealistic. You also need to have a healthy adult functioning. Children know how to play and they make life fun, but they don't get the job done. Your adult also needs to function to make sure that your life stays well-rounded and whole. So we're going to help residents learn to let their kids play while they're here.
We make them play baseball. Oh, I don't like baseball. Too bad. We make them play baseball. We try to help them learn how to play. And we help them learn to be responsible. Did you know, this may sound kind of dorky, it'll sound like high school again. Did you know you can lose your level for not keeping your room cleaned up here? There's one parent enjoying that one. Housekeeping isn't going to clean your room up. That's up to you. And if you want mice living in your clothes because you never pick them up or wash them or whatever, well, that's up to you. But you may not get your next level. There's some responsibility. You've got to deal with life because we want you to learn to have some adult functioning. Let's see. We're going to move on here. Accepting adulthood is pretty difficult for some of our residents because they've been frozen in time. And although their bodies have continued to get older, they're still young on the inside. And they don't have very well-developed, healthy living skills. So we're going to help them develop some fundamental living skills. It may be as fundamental as learning to keep a checkbook balanced, or learning how to cook, or learning how to do relationships in healthy ways, like assertiveness, or giving, or serving. A lot of different kinds of life skills that will help the residents practice while they're here. Let me talk about two or three of those. First one. This is related to something we began earlier. Empowerment through powerlessness. Empowerment through powerlessness. Let me give you a parallel specific to an eating disorder. The way to get your eating disorder under control is to get in control, right? Right, Melinda? The way to get your eating disorder under control is to stop controlling, is to admit that you can't control it. The way to deal with your powerlessness is to admit that you are powerless. Because in that process, you tap into the life process and the power of God that will give you then the power in that situation. Let me describe it another way. I am blessed to have achieved a lot in my life and hope I'm not through yet. When you are given gifts, it is easy to become proud of those gifts. And in my own life, I cling to my powerlessness to guard me from arrogance. Arrogance is believing that you, in and of yourself, are sufficient. And you're not. I don't care how gifted you are. In and of yourself, you are not sufficient. You need things outside yourself. You need relationships. You need acceptance by others. You need a spiritual feeding. There are all sort of things that you need from out here. And until you can acknowledge that sense of powerlessness or that neediness, you won't ever truly become empowered in those areas. So we work that over and over and over with the residents here in every angle we can think of to help them learn to stop fighting for it and to surrender and accept it. Second one. Let's see. I mentioned assertiveness. Let me just elaborate on anger and assertiveness for a second. We put a lot of energy into trying to help the residents learn to ask for what they need in appropriate ways. Periodically somebody, it just happened the other day, I think maybe it was Mary Kay, she said, what do you think, should I apply for my level already? I don't know who it was. My response was, sure, go for it. I didn't say, yeah, you'll get it. She may or may not. The point is, should you ask for what you need? Absolutely. How are you going to get it if you don't ask for it? Well, maybe they'll figure it out. Stop depending on other people to get you what you need. Learn to ask for it. We help people learn to express anger in appropriate ways, but as strong as they need to. Anger is like fire. It can rage out of control and burn through a forest.
Or it can be harnessed and like an acetylene torch. It can cut through stuff and it can weld stuff. Anger is very powerful when used appropriately. And so we teach people assertiveness and how to use that assertiveness to build the relationships that they want to. The last one I'll mention here in terms of healthy living skills. This is something I want you to take home with you after Family Week. Repeated experiences that keep us close to our hearts. We do Family Week for three reasons. One is because it's an extremely effective way to do family therapy, and you can't treat eating disorders successfully without family therapy. So we do Family Week partly because it's an effective way to do family therapy. Secondly, it's an efficient way to do family therapy when we work with residents from all over the nation. So it's an efficient way to do that. Thirdly, it is part of what keeps our staff healthy. We put a lot of energy into this week. All of our staff work more than their usual hours during family weeks. It is a time-consuming way to do therapy. But what it does for us is keep us close to our hearts. Every time one of you share your pain and your story with us, it's a gift. Us. It reminds us of our own journey, where we've been, where we are, and where we want to go. So this is an experience that we use that keeps us close to our hearts. I have other staff. Kathy, the art therapist, has been sitting in on some of our sessions in the afternoon. There are always extra staff in the afternoon sessions observing and participating for what it does for us as well as what it does for the resident. What are you going to do when you go home that will keep you close to your heart? Another thing I do is worship, like the chapel singing that we do. That just really keeps my heart open. And maybe that's something that you want to add to your lifestyle when you go home. Something that keeps your heart open. That's what will keep that woundedness available for healing so that it doesn't become like that 170-pound tumor. It doesn't keep growing. It gets dealt with at the time. So stay close to your heart. Find a way, build it into your life that will keep you vulnerable and soft and open. Now there's one other life skill that I want to talk about. It's one of these healthy living skills, but it's so important that I give it a category of its own, and we will close with this. The last thing that I want to talk about is learning to grieve. Now, why is grieving, why do I call that a living skill? We usually associate grieving with death. So, in what way is it a living skill?
We lose things all the time.
Yeah, because death is a part of life. We do experience one kind of loss or death or another throughout our life. It may be the death of a parent. One of the husbands is dealing with that this week. When years ago, when he did lose his mom, and that grieving process didn't occur, it's happening now, because that will occur. It may get stuffed. One of the ways, in fact, to define depression is unresolved grief, because if that grief is not expressed, it pools and stagnates inside and may turn into depression. That's one of the ways to define depression. So people have got to be able to grieve. Now, how did your parents teach you to grieve? See, most of the time, the way we teach our children to grieve is by not doing it. You know, we bury the family pet who dies while they're at school so they won't have to deal with that. We don't take them to funerals because we don't want them to get upset. We don't let them know. We move, and we don't want them to be sad about the friends that they're leaving behind, so we buy them off. We do all sorts of things to prevent them from grieving. How are they going to be able to do it when they grow up? They're not going to be able to do it. And so part of what we do in therapy here is learn how to grieve. We sat there with Anne
yesterday, and how hard it was for her to grieve the loss of that trust relationship with her sister. Because Anae doesn't do grief real well. There are a lot of things she does real well, but that's not one of them. And so we have to help people learn to do that grieving. When you can't grieve, you cannot do this. You cannot let go if you can't grieve, whatever that may mean. Letting go is a skill, and when you let go of something, there's going to be a sense of loss, and if you don't grieve that loss, then you won't let go of it. You'll hang on to it. Now, let me explain two or three of the reasons why letting go is so important. Let me define it first. Letting go is the process of focusing my awareness on the present moment, rather than letting my awareness be captured by some other experience or event or relationship. Focusing my awareness in the present moment rather than letting my awareness be captured by some other event or relationship or experience. And when I can do that, when I can focus my awareness in the present moment, it is what will let my life live in a balanced way. It happens like this. Some of you, when you go to the beach on vacation, take your briefcase. You don't quite leave the office. You don't let go of the work responsibility. You try to take your work with you on vacation, and you end up strung out instead of balanced. And you ruin your vacation because you're worrying about what you didn't get done at the office, and you forgot to bring something with you that you were planning on doing, and you get back to the office, and you're so furious that you didn't have a restful vacation that the next week is wasted too, because you didn't let go of one and do the other. You continue to compare your current relationship to the one you used to have, wondering if maybe that one, maybe I should have held on, or this isn't quite as good as, or boy, this is so better than. But you end up continuing to live strung out instead of focused and aware of right now. You worry about the body you used to have instead of being able to accept the body you have. You worry about what you might have been able to accomplish if such and such hadn't occurred instead of letting go of that. We continue to be haunted by ghosts from the past or fears from the future that cripple us and paralyze us in the present, because we can't let go. A lot of you are doing letting go about the eating disorder this week. In all of your attempts to hold on to her and keep her healthy, has it worked? Let it go. In all of your fear about whether she will be a part of your future, has it helped? Let it go. In all of your self-abuse about your history, has that made a positive difference in your present? Let it go. Letting go will allow you to live for the moment and get the most out of this time in your life. I'm going to read you a poem. I have a handout for you when we're closed that includes a definition of letting go and this poem that I'm about to read, as well as the quotation from Helen Keller that we started with. To let go does not mean to stop caring. It means I can't do it for someone else. To let go is not to cut myself off. It's the realization that I can't control another. To let go is not to enable, but to allow learning from natural consequences. To let go is not to try to change or blame another. It is to make the most of myself. To let go is not to care for, but to care about. To let go is not to fix, but to be supportive. It is not to judge, but to allow another to be a human being. To let go is not to be in the middle, arranging all of the outcomes. but to allow others to affect their own destinies. To let go is not to be protective. It is to permit another to face reality. To let go is not to deny, but to accept. It is not to nag, scold, or argue with, but instead to search out my own shortcomings and correct them. To let go is not to criticize and regulate anyone, but to try and become what I dream I can be. To let go is not to regret the past, but to grow and live for the future. To let go is to fear less and love more. I hope that there are many things that you take home with you, but I also hope that there are many things that you let go of and leave here.